Okay. So, we're going to talk a bit about intellectual property today. Before we get started, however, any questions about what's going to happen tomorrow? I mean, Thursday, sorry. It's Thursday. Our next lecture. Yes. No, so there'll be one at a time. It'll be at most two at a time. I have to look at the time that we have available.
Okay.
But you won't be running. There'll be nobody next to you. They will be across from you.
Okay, that's the
qualifying round. Qualifying is after Thursday, you're running against all four teams are running. And while we're talking about that, after this week, I would practice against other teams. It does fundamentally change the kind of nature of the contest once other teams are trying to go for the same stuff as you. You have a question? That's right. Open lab hours, not office hours. Yeah. I would not wait until that time to finish your design. Again, I highly recommend you come in with your team and actually practice a full run through of setting up, getting it boxed, pushing the button on the track to make it run. Okay, I would advise against Thursday in class being your first time doing that. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about intellectual property. We probably won't take our whole time, and then we'll have open hours starting at 6. 6 until 9 tonight. Intellectual property is an important thing to understand, particularly if you're going to be a designer. It's really, in terms of your company, what you're really generating for them. Right? So we're going to talk about patents. There's a few different types of patents, and one in particular that you're probably going to be getting in terms of your career. We'll talk about the application process for that kind of patent. We'll look at an example case. The U.S. patent system has been reformed relatively recently, so we want to look at kind of what that means for you. We'll talk a little bit about what's the value of a patent, how much is a patent actually worth, and then some other ways to protect your intellectual property. Okay. The first step in any of these processes, getting started, is to document the invention process. Right? You need documentation of what's going on throughout the entire process of you inventing something. Right? That's why labs keep detailed lab notebooks, keep version control systems, GitHub. You can have private repositories on there monitoring your progress. That's super important. Okay? A little bit less important than it used to be given our changes in our system, but still super important. Okay? To document the process moving forward. And this is just one of many reasons that you should have a good documentation of your process. Okay? Second step for you as an engineer is to know the intellectual property policy of your company or organization. Okay? How many of you guys know the intellectual property policy of UL? Anybody? You're all working under it, whether you realize it or not, as students here. Okay? If you're employed here, even as an undergraduate student researcher, you are an employee of UL, you're treated just like an employee of UL. Okay? So what does that mean? Well, there's a couple sites that tell you what our intellectual property policies are. Right? There's also a policy, because we are part of the UL system, we're also subject to that intellectual property policy. So what does that mean if you're an employee? That means this. This is the language from that document, and I'll highlight kind of the one sentence that's probably most important here. It's basically anything you work on in your area of expertise, UL owns. Okay? I built something in my garage. It's mechanical engineering stuff. UL owns that. Okay? They might choose to let me have it, but by default, it's theirs. And that's the case for a lot of companies. If you're working in your area of expertise, even on your own time, company owns that property. So you need to be aware of that. Not true for all companies. True for many, many companies. Okay. And because they own it, the ownership of the intellectual property from that invention belongs to UL. UL is going to get any money that's made off of that patent licensure. All right. For students, you guys have a little bit easier, and this holds true, basically, even if you are an undergrad researcher, right? If you're a research apprentice, I know a few of you guys in here are research apprentice, you're a UL employee, This holds for you. Okay. If you're a student, however, they give you a little bit of a break. And basically, if you're not considered university personnel, and you don't significantly use UL resources, then UL let you have your idea. Yes?
Resources as far as courses?
Or? Formula SAE, UL owns all your IP. You're using significant UL resources, storing your vehicle here, using the UL trailer, using the UL machine shop. It owns your IP. All right. Of course, they may not want it, but they have right of first refusal, according to this.
Okay. Right. But as far as like other things, let's say like courses or anything other than using the actual.
Yeah, the point that you probably could argue is no more than incidental use of university property. So if you really wanted to go to court over this, I think that's the line that you could go to court over.
But this is not referring to.
No, I'm just talking in general.
Okay.
Right. Oh, I. What is it? What is incidental use of UL resources mean? Right. That's a sentence I think lawyers would fight over. What does that? What does that mean? Is it using the 201 lab? Is that more than incidental use of your resources? I don't know. Right. That's depending on how much your invention is worth, probably how are they going to fight you on that? Right. But this, you know, I point this out because this is the letter of the law. Right. So you should be aware of this. You should take a look at this section of your contract when you sign a contract with a company and be aware that they might own even what you invent in your garage if it's in your area of expertise. And again, if you want to look at this in more detail, the links are in the webpage, in the presentation. Okay. Patent types. Utility patents cover how things work. Design patents cover how things look effectively. Okay. So most of the patents you would be working on and getting as an engineer are going to be utility patents. So an algorithm, a mechanism, a machine, it's generally going to be a utility patent. How the machine looks, the body shape of a car is kind of covered utility patent type stuff. Okay? So let's talk more about utility patents, is what we'll talk about most of the time. Let's talk about qualifying for a patent. U.S. used to be first to invent. Okay? For up until very, very recently, U.S. system was first to invent. It meant whoever invented the thing first had the right to the patent. Even if someone had already patented the idea, if you could prove you invented it before them, you got that patent instead of them. Okay? So that's one reason that documenting your process was super, super important, even more so than it is now. Okay? So you had to have evidence of your conception of the idea. You had to be able to prove that, yes, I invented this in 1982, even though the patent didn't come until 1990 or whatever. Okay? Sometime in the past. And basically, you have to have evidence of conception, so some proof you invented it, some diligence, meaning you actually have some study that shows that it would really work, okay? And it's reduced to practice, means it's repeatable. You could do it again and again and again and again. You didn't just get lucky one time and it worked, and that's it, okay? Most of the rest of the world was first to file, meaning whoever filed for the patent first is who had the rights to it. As of 2013, which is not that long ago in terms of legal stuff, we're first to file as well. So whoever files for that patent first on an idea is who has the rights to it. Okay. So we're first to file. The same things hold, though. You have to kind of have some proof that you invented it. Your notes are still important, even though if you're first to file. You still have to demonstrate that it works in some way, and it still has to be reduced to practice. Has to be repeatable, something that can be done regularly. It's not just a lucky happenstance. Okay. So what is the function of a patent? Patent is really about the right to exclude. Right? All patent says is that you can stop other people from using your idea if you want to. Doesn't say you're going to make any money off of it. Doesn't say that they're legally obligated in a criminal sense to not copy your idea. Means you have the right to go to them in civil court and try to get royalties from them copying your idea. You have the right to exclude them from manufacturing. Okay? And basically 20 years. And for these utility patents, again, it could be a machine, process. Okay, those are probably the two most common that you guys would be working on. Article of manufacture is a little bit less clear, like the actual widget itself is the invention, which could be different than the machine. Machine's like kind of like a mechanism. Okay? So, given that, what do you guys think the requirements for patentability? What does an invention have to have to be patented? Be patentable? You said lucrative. No, you hope it is. It doesn't have to be.
Has to be not in patent already.
Sure.
Documentation.
Documentation, like we just talked about. Okay.
Demand for it?
Nope. No requirement for that, for you to patent it. Your company might want you to do that before they pay for your patent, but that is not required by law to be a patentable idea. Some kind of documentation, whether it's blueprints or schematics or code flow diagrams.
Money?
But again, that's not kind of a legal requirement.
An idea.
What's that?
An idea,
sure. Idea alone is probably not enough. It has to be a certain type of idea. Really, it has to be new. And new, kind of in the novelty in terms of the kind of patent law, includes these things. It means before the patent application has been filed, it can't be known, right? It can't be something that just engineers know about already, right? Can't have been used. You also could not have publicly disclosed your invention before you file for the patent. If you invent something and you're going to trade shows and trying to sell it to people, that's not a patentable idea anymore. If you've done that before you file for the patent. Because you've already publicly disclosed your idea. Okay? You can't offer to sell it to people, even in private. Right? Because you've disclosed your idea before you file for the patent. Right? So if you have an idea, you want to get a patent for it, you better be filing for the patent before you go to any kind of exhibitions or trade shows or conferences, even if they're academic conferences, discussing that idea. All right? Second piece of the puzzle, it kind of comes also with the new, right? It has to have utility, meaning it's useful. And these are words that pretty much all patent cases are fought over. Does this invention actually have some utility? Is it novel and non-obvious to a practitioner skilled in the field? Okay. And what that means is, could, given the body of work that came before your patent existed, before you filed for your patent, could another engineer have sat down and easily come up with the same idea you did? Is it an obvious extension to the existing state of the art? Yes. Yes. Within your company, yeah. Yeah. Yes.
So if you come up with an idea that has multiple parts to it but never come together, let's say an idea from here and another one, and you merge them together and they actually produce
sure.
something, does that count?
So the question is, if I have my kind of merging ideas in a unique way, is it eligible for a patent? I think what's the question is still this one. And this is the legal question. Is it novel? And would that combination of different ideas have been not obvious to someone that's skilled in the practice? So could another engineer, given the same body of knowledge, same at that time, sat down and obviously gotten to the same idea you did? And again, that sounds kind of nebulous, and that's one reason this is one of the points they fight about in court cases all the time. Right? Oh, no, this is just an obvious extension of this so-and-so's patent. Right? And we'll talk about the process, and that's quite often the patent office will come back to you once you submit a patent and say, no, that's obvious to this person. And you typically will have a chance to respond. No, that's not obvious because of this, and this. Right? So during the process, you can have a chance to argue this, but quite often, this is what the real meaning of these words is what gets argued in patent court cases. Okay? So you can't have publicly disclosed it, can't have done any of these things, and it has to have utility, novelty, and be non-obvious to a practitioner skilled in the art. Okay? Related to your question, though, is most patents are evolutionary. Right? There's very few stuff we do as engineers that's built from zero upon no previous knowledge. Right? Pretty much everything we do as humans, more or less, is built on some previous knowledge. Right? But that building, the evolution has to be an evolution in a way that's not obvious to a practitioner skilled in the art. So given that, we've kind of already talked through this. Ways to lose patent rights: public demonstration, going to exhibition, talking at a conference, going to a trade show. Okay. Public disclosure also falls into public testing. Okay. Giving out beta versions of your software or something like that before you file for the patents. Okay. One of your employees getting mad at your company and go blabbing their mouth about your invention. It's now public. All right. Try to start selling it before you file for the patent, you've lost the rights to that patent. So doing any of those things, you lose the right to patentability. Okay. So critical dates, most countries, the U.S. included, you have to file an application before that public disclosure. The U.S. and some other countries have this other kind of idea. It's called a provisional patent application. And basically what it says is, I'm planning to file a patent for this idea. Okay? And you have 1 year from that date of filing that paperwork to file the actual patent. Okay? The advantage of this is that once you file the provisional patent, you can start going to trade shows and doing public disclosures because you've already disclosed it to the patent office. Okay? So this 1 year, you are protected during this year. Right? You're kind of now past the barrier to where you can show it to other people. So quite often what will happen is during this 1 year, you're trying to figure out, and these are much cheaper to get and much easier to get. There's a much less rigorous review of these than the full patent. Right? So you would file this. Then you have the year to do your homework effectively. Is it going to be worth our money to get this patent? Is it a lucrative idea? We can start talking to customers. Do they actually want this? Right? You can do a more detailed patent search, previous work. Is this patent going to get rejected or accepted based on what we see? Which you should kind of know that already. You've been doing your homework. But basically, it puts the flag in the sand. We invented this on this day. Right? And you have 1 year of that time to file the full patent. This, although it's called a provisional patent application, it doesn't automatically roll into a patent. You have to submit an entirely separate packet of paperwork for the full patent. So this is not the patent application. This is just kind of a placeholder. I invented this thing. I'm planning to file a full patent within the next year. Okay. At most companies, including UL, you have to file with your intellectual property division of your company. So every company is going to have one, some lawyers in charge of IP. You have to file what's called an invention disclosure. And that's us, in a sense, telling UL, hey, we have something that we think is worth patenting or worth protecting from intellectual property. That goes off to that office, and they decide whether it's worth filing a provisional application, and then within the year after the provisional, filing for the full application. Okay. So one of these applications, these internal disclosures, often look quite a lot like your 201, the reports you're doing here. Right? Here's the problem we're solving. Here's our solution. Here's how we think that's a good solution. Okay. So let's talk about that provisional patent application again. So it's got a 1 year life. So you must file the full patent within a year of filing that provisional. If you don't, you can't patent that ID anymore. It's public after that. All right. Okay. So for many international patents, you have 30 months from that provisional application to file. The international part gets a bit complicated. So if you're going to, companies going after international patents, they probably have a pretty good law team. Provisional patent, as I mentioned already, never issues as a patent. It's really just a placeholder in time. Right, so I invented it on this date. I was the first one to file this stuff. No one else can file for that idea while your provisional is active. Okay, and it gives you the opportunity to go out and try to sell to people. Okay. The big point about the provisional application is we say it must be enabling for the application. It means that everything that's going to be in that patent application must have been explained in the provisional application. So you can't just file a provisional and then protect some idea, some different idea, and file for that patent a year later. So the provisional and the patent have to be on the same idea, is what this means. And enabling is kind of the legal word for that. Okay. Preparing a utility patent application. It's iterative. You're going to have to help out the attorney. Although most of the patent attorneys are pretty good. A lot of them have technical degrees. Quite a large number of them have technical degrees, actually. If you're looking to make some really good money as an engineer, someone with an engineering background, be a patent attorney, and get paid pretty well. Okay. So you're going to have to spoon feed the patent attorney. They'll have technical expertise, but not necessarily in your area specialty. So you're going to have to help them along. Drawings are very important, just like they are for our designs in this class. Right. Those drawings showing how the design works, what the algorithm is important. U.S. patent applications has these sections. Abstract, which is a one paragraph statement of the invention. That should sound pretty familiar. Background of the invention. That's kind of, here's the problem being solved and ways people have tried to solve this problem before. That should sound a lot like your introduction for our reports, right? Okay. Then immediately go into the summary of the invention. That should sound pretty familiar too. Right? And here's a problem being solved. Here's our answer, just like we do in our reports in here. Okay? Where it starts to deviate from kind of our reports is patents have a completely separate section that just describes the figures. Just dryly describes figure one is this paragraph. Figure two is this paragraph describing figure two. Figure three is this. Just in the order the figures come. So it's a description, essentially the caption plus a little bit more for each figure. Okay, then the figures are all bundled together. Right. What we also have, so the preferred embodiments, there's a separate section. The invention generally is the mechanism. Here's the algorithm we're going to use. The preferred embodiments are kind of how this thing would be made and sold or something to that effect. So here I have this new input, this new controller I designed. It could be used on a crane this way. It could be used on a robotic arm in this way. It could be used on an autonomous boat in this certain way. Those would be preferred embodiments. How is this idea actually going to be used? And then the biggest section, the kind of most important section really, is actually at the end because it needs all that stuff for the person to understand what these claims are. And the entire document really supports these. The claims are kind of the biggest point. They're what you're saying is new. Okay. And we'll see what those look like in a minute. Okay. A timeline for this. So let's start at this time. You're filing your provisional patent. Okay. Within that 12 months, you have to file the full application. And then quite often during that 12 months, you can have some further development. Everything just has to have been included in the provisional. So you can clean things up, do some more experiments, that kind of thing. You start doing some market research to see whether it's worth getting the full patent or not. Okay. Once you file the application, it's going to be, in my experience, at minimum, 8 to 14 months before the patent office will let you know something. The fastest I've ever had it is 14 months. They'll come back to you and say, hey, actually, Jane Doe invented this thing in 1973 or whatever. No, Jane Doe's thing is different than ours because of this. Right? So you'll have an action. You'll have an option to reply, and typically they'll give you 1 to 6 months to do that, reply to their decision. Right. Pretty much always, they're going to reject some part of your patent. Right. Some part of your claims. No, these three claims you made are actually covered by this other patent, and these three are covered by patent number three. So you have 1 to 6 months to address those questions by the patent office, right? And then they'll take 1 to 6 months. Again, that's the fastest I've ever had it happen, that kind of time range. I think I've had 4 months. And you can loop on that for a long time. So one patent I have, we did that 4 or 5 times at 6 months, kind of each cycle. This is a multi-year process, this kind of loop we're showing right now. Once it is get approved, or sometimes, quite often, it might be some segment of the patent is approved. Okay, it'll be 1 to 3 months before they offer an allowance, which basically means, hey, you can give you time to pay your fee for the patent, and then the patent issues. Okay, and so if you add all this up, I think you're 26 to 44 months if you're lucky. Okay. It takes a long time to get for a patent to fully issue. Yes?
As far as the fees, how much is there?
The fee itself, I don't know the fee itself. But I do know that the fee itself is really small compared to what you're paying lawyers this whole time. All right. So, actually, I might have that. Nope, I don't. So, patents costs break down something like this based on what I've seen. So quite often there will be some preliminary stuff, and you can do some of this yourself. Right? You can search the patent, back patents, and see, you know, see what work's come before, make sure that nobody else in your area. And in fact, if you're working kind of research lab or something, you would know the prior research anyway. So you would kind of have some idea about this. And then patent lawyers, as I said, are not cheap. So it can get really, really expensive. Okay. So for the most part, you better hope your patent is a lucrative patent, or you're going to lose a lot of money getting the patent. Okay. And I think the majority of patents that are filed actually lose money for this reason. You spend a lot of money getting it, and you get no money from it. Patent duration. So the main point of the patent process is, yeah, to allow your company to protect your idea, but kind of the idealistic view of the patent process is that after the patent's over, then anybody can use that idea and the world's a better place because of it or whatever. Okay. So if you have CVS brand Tylenol, CVS brand acetaminophen, you're a product of that. The world's a better place because you can get cheap CVS brand Tylenol. Their patent ran out on that formula. All right. So once expired, the invention is public domain. It's kind of the idealistic kind of idea that the patent process is based on. We want people to release their inventions into this process so that in a certain amount of time, anybody can use that idea freely. Okay. Design patents, again, that's how something looks. We'll have 14 years from the issue date. Utility patents, pretty much anything you file now, will be 20 years from the earliest effective filing date. Okay, so that includes the one-year provisional if you file a provisional. Right. So you file a provisional, got 1 year, you file a patent. It takes 2 years, let's say, to get the full patent. You have 17 years after the patent issued. So it's 20 years from the earliest effective filing date. Okay. You are somewhat protected, so if you see patent pending on things, that means they've applied. Doesn't mean they have a patent or are going to get a patent. Okay. 20 years. So let's look at some claims. So that's kind of the most important part of these patents. It's what the whole patent, everything else in that patent is meant to support. Patent claims. So here's one. I'll give you just a second to read it. It's a lot of words. Everybody got it? Okay. So this would be claim one in a certain patent. And this is the foundational patent for some of the crane control stuff that I do. Okay. So you would have claim one, the kind of core piece of the patent. This is the main idea. You want this to be written as general as possible. Right? You want this to apply as broadly as possible, particularly in the first submission. And then the patent office will say, no, no, you need to trim it back. Okay. Well, you'll have claim one, and you'll have all these other subclaims that start off with pretty much the same language. The method of claim one plus some other stuff. Or the method of claim one except this part's changed a little bit. So these are kind of subclaims. So you have major claims and minor claims. Right? So everything like sub one, but we're going to use impulses. Okay. And you'll see that this kind of process continues. You might have 10 of these, and then a new major claim, and 10 minor claims under that, that are the method of claim two plus this other stuff, or except this is different than that. Right. So this patent covers, I mentioned, showed you guys some crane videos the first day. This method covers this idea called input shaping. So this video is from a company that started from MIT, my PhD advisor. I'll show you the video, and then we'll talk about kind of that process.
This is a demonstration that involves input shaping technology for reducing residual vibrations.
Let me stop for just a second. So that part you saw, that this technology was developed at MIT. It's owned by MIT. They let that graduate student professor start a company and license the technology to that company. Universities love that kind of stuff. Okay? So that's quite often what might happen in your, even in your company. You should come up with something really, really novel. They might let your division spin out or something to that effect. Right? But the company's still going to own the IP. And then you can negotiate some licensure of that intellectual property, possibly exclusive to your company, right? And they're going to, universities want us, you guys, to go out and start companies with ULIMP, and then you'll have to pay them a small percentage of whatever profit you make or whatever. So that patent covering that idea was 100 pages long, had 60 drawings, it had 130 claims, and my advisor, actually is listed as the first inventor here, Singhals, said it took him 3 to 4 months of just writing. And that's kind of writing the version that he gave to the lawyer, who then spent a bunch of time turning it into lawyer speak. Okay. So, here's the patent. It's filed, you see it was issued June 10th, 1997. You guys had that startup company that you saw the video for. They had this project for what would become Seagate hard drives. And they had this mechanism that was designed to actually test the hard drives. So it was not the drive itself. You put one of those old kind of spinning platter drives, not an SSD at that time, obviously. Test the drive, and actually it has a problem with the test mechanism was vibrating and messing up the test. Right? So they said, okay, this input shaping stuff, we can use that on the test mechanism. So involved in this project for what will become Seagate. And works great. And so they, being a company, pitched Seagate. We can actually do this to your hard drive. Right? So the old spinning platter hard drive works a lot like a record player. Right? That you move the read head around, there's a little motor and arm that moves the read head as the disk is spinning to the right groove, effectively. Right? So even a little bit of vibration in that read head will delay being able to read the data that's on the disk. And we're talking about super, super small amounts of time, but every little millisecond, every nanosecond, microsecond matters when you're talking about getting data off a disk and trying to make the computer faster. So if you can get there without vibration, it's going to be a big win. Particularly when you're doing this for the whole life of the computer, anytime the computer's doing anything, it's reading off that disk effectively, particularly in 1997. Pitch this idea, hey, we can do this to your hard drives. Company that would become Seagate says, hey, that's great, but no thanks. Okay? What do you think happened? Seagate, they didn't try to do it themselves, they did it themselves. Okay? So that results in this big, huge lawsuit. Okay? And that's the first point I want to make about these patents, is they give you the right to exclude someone, but you have to go to court to do it. Right? And if you're a small little startup company, like Convolve was, Seagate and a lot of big companies are probably going to make the bet, or may make the bet, that we can just take this. There's no way that company is going to be able to fight us and stop us from doing it. Right? So they made that choice. Right? So what will become Seagate, the original company, end up being a few different things? Evolve finds out they took it and said, hey, we're going to sue you guys. Okay? And they start this lawsuit. And the kind of founder of the company, Neil Singer is the guy, he went out, instead of getting investments in his company or in new research and development for his engineering company, went out and got investments in this lawsuit. So he ended up getting millions of dollars of investments, effectively betting that he was going to win the lawsuit. That didn't go into engineering time. The company effectively quit operation because they had this big lawsuit going on that was taking all their resources, all their time. Right? So this lawsuit did kind of destroy this company. So ends up after many years. So you saw that patent was filed 97. First court case, you know, basically starts 2000, not too much longer. 2008, we get our first decision. And this is actually for some small piece of the decision. Right? These big kind of lawsuits will tend to settle in pieces, some patent suits, depending on who's violating what. Okay, so this is 8 years later of paying lawyers to work on this case, millions of dollars. Okay, a year later, about, an ex-employee of Seagate comes forward and says, hey, we actually know we took that, which that changes a patent case quite a bit. Right? So if you infringe on someone's patent unknowingly, you're still infringing. They still can sue you. Typically, the damages are going to be less. Right? If you willingly infringe on someone's patent, kind of the process is the same until it comes to how much they can really ding you for money-wise. So the Seagate employee came forward and said, hey, we knew we were doing that. Okay. So basically that. And then we get another partial settlement, 2011, 11 years after all this stuff started. And they originally sued for, what was it, $80 million. So some of that company ended up being part of Dell. Dell had to pay $1.5 million. Western Digital had to pay $2.5 million. Hitachi had to pay $1.4 million. So didn't really get a whole lot out of that. In the meantime, Seagate probably made hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, on those hard drives. Okay. So I don't tell you this story to discourage you from getting patents. I just want you guys to be aware of the reality that a patent by itself is not worth a whole lot. Right? A patent's worth you or your company's ability to defend it. And that's even if it has customers and things worth defending, worth someone stealing. U.S. Patent Reform, 2011, this act was passed, basically moving the first to file and allowing someone other than the inventor to file. Used to be, if you were the inventor, you actually had to file the paperwork yourself. Now your lawyer can actually turn it in for you, which is nice. Another big change, and you see some kind of websites around, basically, once it's filed, third parties can submit prior art. So if Google finds out Apple's filing for this patent, Google can say, no, 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 that patent is like this one from 3 years ago that we filed during the process. They don't have to wait until afterwards. Right? And then once the patent is issued, there's a 9-month window after issue for anyone to challenge that issuance. So you can see that a patent was issued, have some objection to it being issued, and raise that with the patent office. Okay. And these changes were made largely to make administration of the patent office less expensive and more efficient and maybe in other ways as well. Right? So if you have to figure out who the actual inventor was for every case, which is what our system was set up to do, that's kind of burdensome from a bureaucratic standpoint. Now it's just whoever filed the stuff first is who's going to get it. Right? So because of that last one, right, you'll see, you know, sites like this one pop up where people will be arguing about recently issued patents and should be issued or not and filing stuff with the patent office. It's kind of interesting to watch some of those discussions. And I have the full text of that, which we won't read. Okay. So what do you guys think about first to invent versus first to file? Which is more fair? First to file is more fair? Okay. Everybody agree with that? Nowadays it is, maybe, okay. Okay.
I mean, theoretically, a multi-billionaire, say, could do 100 patents of what he thinks would be future technology, regardless if he invented it or not.
Sure. So that's against it being fair, though, right?
Yeah.
Right? So his point up front was, hey, some rich guy or girl, maybe some company, has the resources to file patents more quickly than an individual inventor. Right? So the first to file, if you have more resources, is in your advantage because you can get all that paperwork done first. And that is actually an argument against first to file. Okay. So that's one argument against first to file and kind of basically an argument for first to invent. Is that who actually invented the thing doesn't matter who filed the paperwork first. That's just paperwork. We care about who actually invented it. Right, is one argument for first to invent. Yes, sir.
I'm not quite sure what company, but I think Google actually has a department that just sits there and thinks about different designs,
Sure.
Not necessarily design or build or anything, just come up with the idea, utilizes the first to file, and then patent the idea before even testing it, before even...
Sure. So the point was, hey, these big companies, Google being one, I think it's going to be common for large companies to have divisions that are looking forward and thinking about intellectual property. And we'll talk about that in a bit more detail later. But yeah, I think you're inventing things, particularly as a big company, and patenting things. We know this is never going to be a product for us. But we still want to patent this, if you're Google, to stop Apple and Samsung from doing it. Well, they have to still have, be able to show that it works. It has to still be non-obvious. All those things still hold for that patent. Right? So you can't just sketch an idea and patent just the idea. You have to have diligence. It has to be reduced to practice. It has to be non-obvious to a practitioner in art. All those requirements still hold. Yes? If Google comes and takes your idea, I think there's not a whole lot you can do. except with the exception of maybe, you might be able to find a good patent lawyer that would say, I would want whatever percent of the winnings if we win, if you have a good case. So you might find a firm willing to do that if you have a good case. But even that's going to be a long road ahead. It's going to be a years of process. Yeah.
So how does Walmart, like laundry detergent, for example, you walk down a laundry detergent aisle, they have, let's say, like a top brand, and then right on the side of it, there's the great value version.
Sure.
They have, like, the same shape. They usually have similar colors.
Right. So the question is kind of generics, right? That's the point I made about CVS version mm-hmm. labeled Tylenol, right? The formula for that detergent was likely patented at some point in time. But that patent has a limited lifespan. After the patent expires, it's public information. Anybody in the public can use it without paying licensure fees. Right? So they can use that formula for the detergent that's the same as Tide or whoever else is the name brand. Right? And that's fine. Right? Tide could still have issue with them if they labeled it as Tide, obviously, because there's different legal issues there. But the actual contents of that container can be exactly the same. Yep. The other kind of argument for first to invent is that an inventor, if you're working on an invention, now you're not so pressured by, I have to file this thing as soon as it works for the first time kind of thing. So inventors can spend more time perfecting an idea before they actually file for the patent. So that, in some sense, that can give them more effective time of coverage for their idea because they've waited longer until it was closer to being finished, let's say, or marketable before they file. Okay. And kind of both of those things favor or tend to favor individual inventors. Right. Big corporations, big entities have the resources to file patents quickly. Most of us don't. Right. So even if you invent something, it's going to take us longer to go from invention to file than a Google or Apple or Samsung, someone like that. The big argument, like I said, for first to file is it's simple administratively. Right? And it pushes ideas to being filed earlier, which, again, you can maybe argue is in the public good. Right? That if an idea is filed earlier, the patent expires earlier, it gets in the public domain earlier, so it can be, we can have Walmart-branded Tide for $1 cheaper or $2 cheaper. And maybe there's some public good from that. Okay, we'll skip through this quickly. I'll leave it in the slides that I'll post. But basically, there's Canada changed in 1989, and kind of we can look at a lot of those things that we just talked about are shown out in the data from that changeover. So we'll skip through this. Okay. Let's talk about the value of a patent. You're looking at patent to effectively, your company's going to evaluate, does filing for this patent and getting this patent increase the value of my company? Right? And that might mean in terms of sales. It might mean in terms of licensure to other companies that have to make this thing. It could be in prestige of having this fancy patent. Right? And in fact, that's the number one reason that startup companies will patent, or one of the main reasons startup-ish companies will go for patents. A lot of them will understand, I can't protect this, but it looks good to an investor if we have a bunch of patents covering our area of work. Right? There's some prestige that comes with that. Okay. So basically, there's some prestige there. You also, if you have filed patents strategically and done a good job as a startup, it will prevent other companies from entering your market. Right? That's kind of hard to do, actually. But there is an opportunity for that. One of the other big values, particularly if you're a small startup-ish company, is that many jurisdictions will have tax credits and things available to research-heavy, tech-active, patented companies, effectively. Right? So you can kind of leverage your patents into better rates on loans and those kind of things if you're a startup-ish company. Okay. So let's talk about defensive patent use. So this is one way that, and one reason that big companies go out and get a bunch of patents around is that basically allows you to bargain with some other company. Google has this idea we know we're never going to use. Apple has some idea. We're never going to use this, but we want to use Google's idea. And okay, we'll just kind of swap. Right? We'll license to each other for free those two ideas or something like that. Right? So having a bunch of patents also allows you to kind of do that. They're trading bargaining chips effectively. And like we talked already, one reason those big companies do that, in addition to bargaining chips, is I know I don't want to make this, but I don't want any of my competitors to be able to make this either. So I'm going to patent that, and if they want to make it, that's fine, but they're going to give me 25% of whatever they do or whatever. So you actually look, I think it's not the case anymore, but the first 5 or 6 years of Android phone sales, Microsoft was making more money off of them than Google because they were licensing some patent from Microsoft. It's kind of interesting. What you also want to do, kind of related to these two things, is effectively increase or raise the barrier to entry to a certain market. We talked about if you had kind of a startup company. Your patents can make companies have to come pay you or license that idea to get into your market. Offensive patent use, kind of same idea. Basically, that barrier is high and they have to come through you, you're going to get, even if it's not your, they're selling to different customers than you, you're going to get some of their money, right? You can get revenue directly from patents, right? There are companies that exist that just do this, right? They go buy patents, buy the rights to patents, and then just collect revenue on the on those patents, right? There are companies that do that, buy up patents, and then just sue people for infringing them, also known as patent trolls. Right. Okay. So, what do you think makes a patent valuable? Given what we discussed, patents seem like maybe they're not worth it. Okay. Talk about it being valuable in terms of prestige. Okay. What about valuable in terms of monetary gain, let's say? What do you think a valuable patent looks like? Sure, okay, so I think what you're hitting at is something like this, maybe, right? That's valuable if you are a step above your competition, effectively, right? So you have some new technology, right, that is a step change in your industry. It's going to make, it's going to be the technology that differentiates you from all the other companies trying to sell phones. Is it my cell phone camera is so great, it's almost like a real camera. You can have inventions that create new industries. There's been some of that this decade, right? What also makes those kind of inventions pretty nice is that an invention is so new it has very little prior art, right? So we talked about most patents being evolutionary, right? If you get early on in that evolution chain, right, what that lets you do is make your claims very broad. Because there's nobody else that's tried to solve this problem really like this before. So you can end up with coverage over a huge swath of the market. Okay. And we kind of already talked about these ideas, right? Companies, the big companies, this is kind of what we talked about. I don't need this idea, but to get to my main idea, you have to go through these three things that I have patents on. Okay, because you just kind of set up roadblocks towards the real solution you're working towards. So maybe you're not ready to patent your main idea, but you know these technologies are needed to build up to that. Hold on to your main idea, patent these things while you keep working on the main idea. And that will prevent your competitors from getting to that same point. Okay. And then kind of same thing, you know, tying onto the cell phone, it helps to have a huge customer base. Right? Whether you're measuring number of people or number of dollars. Okay, questions about patents. We'll talk about a few other forms of intellectual property in just a second. Okay. So the key things to remember about patents. Keep track of your work. Be aware of where you're working, what their policy is. Okay. Don't publicly disclose your ideas before you file the provisional patent application. Yes.
Would that be considered a UL as well?
Yes. The presentation, I think, falls like the question earlier. Presenting within your company, because your company is going to be the owner of that patent, is like presenting to yourself, effectively. So that's okay. I think that could be used as proof that you had a date. I think it would have mattered more for the first invent process that you had a date. You shared this internally on this date and presented it internally on a certain date. People were there. They could testify that you gave that presentation. First to file, that doesn't really matter so much if it was internal. It's truly internal. Okay. Copyrights, a little bit different, right? Copyrights are meant and intended to create kind of works of artists. Okay. And they protect expression. It's kind of how it's worded in the law, right? For example, if you have some algorithm, some code you wrote for your patent, how it works, the algorithm itself, could be a utility patent. The actual code, the letters, how they're arranged, you could file a copyright on that if you wanted to. And no one could write that code exactly how you wrote it anymore, or you'd have the right to exclude them from writing it that way. Okay, that tends to be not so useful, actually, because there's a bunch of, as you guys are finding, it's going to have infinitely many ways to write the same algorithm. Right? But if you want, you can copyright your code. Okay, and again, like the patent, basically, you have the right to exclude others from making the same thing. Copyright extends a little bit in that you have the right from kind of making preventing derivative works or a public display of your work. Okay. The term of 70 years from the creation plus the life of the last living author. Okay. Copyrights, if it's owned by a corporation, is 95 years. And Disney really fights these guys. They want their copyright on Mickey Mouse to last forever. All right? Mickey makes a lot of money. And copyrights have no cover or function. Right? So we talked about copyrighting your code. If someone wrote your algorithm and you only copyrighted that code, right, and someone wrote the algorithm using a different computer language, your copyright doesn't cover that. So hopefully you got a patent too. The other major one, it's called a trade secret. Okay, and basically a trade secret is some information within your company that has economic benefit because it's a secret within your company. Okay, so you're not filing for a patent for it, you're keeping it secret. Anybody think of good examples of this? Coke recipe is probably the most famous one. Right? Coke recipe has never been patented. It's supposedly in a vault in Atlanta that you can go visit. Right. So it's a company secret, trade secret. Right. And they haven't patented it because if they patent it 20 years after they file a patent, then it becomes public domain. Okay. So trade secret. These are protected as well. These are criminal. Someone steals your trade secret illegally. And get it. So you can file NDAs, right? So if you are CEO of Coke, I'm sure you have to sign an NDA saying you're not going to steal the Coke recipe, right? But you can, and Coke's just going to come get you, right? So you have much less kind of protection to revealing a trade secret, right? But there's protections. If someone broke into the Coke vault, right, and stole the recipe, right? Coke wouldn't have any protection on other people copying the recipe, but they'll have some recourse against that person, right? Which is probably, they're probably not going to have, that person is probably not going to have the money to cover the damages of the Coke recipe getting out and the money Coke would lose, right? So that's the kind of bet, the game you have to play if you're thinking about trade secrets, is can I really keep this thing a secret? Okay? The other thing about trade secrets is basically you're not protected against someone getting to your same solution, right? So if someone did get to the exact Coke recipe by just reverse from kind of first principles, chemical decomposition, those kind of things, and got to the exact recipe without consulting someone at Coke or getting inside information, nothing Coke can do about that. Okay. And again, someone came and actually stole that trade secret, like literally stole it, that is a criminal offense now. It's a trade secret. But again, I doubt you're going to get from whoever stole the recipe back what you lose in market value. So there's kind of this game you have to play, whether you want trade secrets or patents. Okay, questions about any of that? It's important to be aware of that stuff. No questions. Okay.
I have one.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Okay, so just using UL as an example.
Yes.
So let's say I use extensive UL resources, but then I stop. And then I create something in my backyard, garage, whatever, and I keep it a trade secret. Would UL own that?
Trade secret. Okay, so preface, I'm not a lawyer, et cetera, et cetera. Don't take this as legal advice, okay. All that kind of good stuff. I think if you all found about some kind of trade secret you were keeping, they would want to know at what point your idea deviated from the one that you were using UL resources for.
Okay.
And I think if it didn't deviate enough, then they would want claim to it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. So if you drop out of school and an adventure thing, I think you're fine because you're not a UL student anymore.
Do you think that's why I like a lot of billionaires like drop out of school before they come out with their
Like, you know, like Elon Musk. Yeah, I think a lot of those guys are not necessarily thinking about the patent or that school owning their thing. I think they're just into what they're doing. I think to start that kind of company, Microsoft, Bill Gates, Facebook, whatever you want to think about, takes a certain amount of obsession with that idea. And I think if you're that obsessed with building Microsoft or Facebook or whatever, it's really hard to go to school at the same time. But stay in school. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, lab hours open at 6 tonight, and come see me.